Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second? Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Shout out to our show sponsors, Mint Inc. Mint stands for the Minority Interdisciplinary Networking Team. Mint empowers young minority professionals with an interdisciplinary network for learning, collaboration, and the development of entrepreneurial ventures. Follow them on Instagram at Mint Inc. _USA and look out for the next issue of Mint Mag.
So you want to start a podcast, huh? Well, we got something to help you. The Black Real Estate Dialogue brings you the How to Start a Successful Podcast on a Budget with No Experience ebook and webinar bundle.
We are controlling transmission.
Come and put info into action as we show you the step-by-step process to sharing your successful podcast on a budget. This bundle is full of the exact details, social media hacks, and podcasting process we've used to gain 13,000 downloads and over 10,000 Instagram followers. But that's not all. As a bonus, you'll receive the exact super trackers we use to stay organized and free access to our private Facebook group designed to help you execute. Make sure you click that link now because there is an audience for you to reach. The How to Start a Successful Podcast on a Budget with No Experience, the ebook and webinar bundle presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue. Do you really think investing in real estate is too expensive? Well, you wrong about that. Presenting a beginner's guide to buying your first out-of-state property, a Black Real Estate Dialogue course. That's right, it's the new course presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue, teaching you how to develop the investor's mindset, the advantages of investing out of state, getting your finances in order, finding the right location, assembling your team, creating financing strategies, how to find and analyze properties, how to find tenants, real-life case studies, and so much more in bonus content.
Oh yeah, did we mention you have lifetime access?
My goodness! If you have dreams of buying a property out of state but have no idea where to start, well, this is the guide for you. Learn the tips from someone with firsthand experience. Are you looking for a community of like-minded individuals and access to experts in real estate?
Yeah.
Are you interested in real estate but need more support and guidance?
You know who it is?
The Black Real Estate Dialogue presents the Real Estate Investing Community. No matter how much or how little real estate experience you have, we've created a community for you because your perspective is important. All right, tell me, what's the number one place where you can do Q&A with experienced guest speakers 3 times a month? How about unlimited access to past guest speakers' recordings? What about a private Slack channel to engage in daily discussion with everybody in the community to share resources and support each other? Head on over to gumroad.com/bread. That's gumroad.com/BRED. It's the Real Estate Investing Community presented by the Black Real Estate Dialogue. Come join us today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 60. A few quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to this on. It'll help us move up in the rankings and, of course, help us to reach more people. Also, please leave a review. We definitely will appreciate it. We would love to hear your thoughts and your feedback and what you love about this podcast. If latest updates on what's happening at the Black Real Estate Dialogue, text BRED to 21,000 to join the free VIP text list. If you want to gain early access to episodes, bonus content, discounts on merch, and more, join our Patreon program. Visit patreon.com/BlackStateDialogue to join or visit the link in the show notes. This episode is jam-packed with knowledge. I'm very excited for it. A whole lot of game from Tyron McDaniel out of Houston, Texas. Let me know what you think. Without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. I'm very excited about this episode today. Here with me, I have Tyron McDaniel out of Houston, Texas. Tyron, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Most certainly. Looking forward to being on the show, and it's exciting to be here.
Definitely. So first, I would just love to hear more about what your childhood was like and what you saw or maybe what you didn't see
that shaped your view of building wealth?
Man, so was born and raised here in Houston, Texas, and my dad was a business owner. He owned a trucking company. So early on, I had a model, if you will, for being my own boss, so much so that it shaped, you know, a lot of my, it shaped my future in the sense of, you know, I aspire to be like him. Mm-hmm. To the degree where I went into transportation as my first true career because I wanted to emulate some of the things that he had done. So that was really formative for me early on, and it planted the seed of business ownership, entrepreneurialism, and ultimately wanting to seek financial freedom for myself.
Definitely. That makes sense. And so, you know, can you also share with the audience a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Sure. So, I born and raised here in Houston, Texas, and currently I classify myself as an affordable housing developer and home builder, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into it as we kind of dialogue a little bit more. But I followed a path that kind of the more traditional route of entering real estate. But now, you know, I consider myself proverbially to kind of be at the top of the food chain. And I mean that in the sense of when you can build and develop, then, you know, it positions you, if you will, where you can do some things that if you were only investing in existing properties or things of that nature, where, you know, there's still a couple of levels to kind of add to what it is that you're doing. So, yeah, affordable housing and inner city development specialist, if you will.
Definitely. And so one thing you mentioned is that your first career was kind of in transportation, and you know, you also mentioned what you do now. So how did you get to where you are now? How did you get into real estate from a transportation background?
Sure. So, you know, the funny part about life is as you kind of get older and you matriculate a little bit, you start looking back and from, you know, it's been called serendipity, you know, a seemingly unrelated events that all of a sudden tie things together. And so when I look back, you know, I have four brothers I have four brothers and sisters, three sisters and a brother, so it's five of us. And one of my second oldest sister, I can recall her getting a Habitat house and, you know, having to volunteer hours. And so as a kid, as a teenager in high school, I helped build her house, and that planted a seed. Later on in life, when I got a vehicle, me and my buddies used to kind of drive and hang around and go. And when we would see a nice house in one part of town, we'd be like, you know, we'd ride, "Hey, man, let me take you over here on the south side. I seen this real dope house," you know. So it's funny looking back that I had these experiences. And so once I got into the workforce, I went to college for a semester. I didn't graduate. I quituated. And then went directly into the workforce. And so over a period of time, you know, I still wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I was working a job and things of that nature. And just through a series of, again, serendipitous events, I met a friend who wanted to own a mortgage company. I didn't know what a mortgage company was at the time, but after getting a little bit of understanding that they provide the financing for people wanting to buy a home and refinance, the epiphany I got was, if you can understand the financing associated with real estate, you could eventually buy, build, or sell anything you want. So my initial entry into the space was we were going to start a mortgage company. So the beginning step to doing that was he got me a job working for another mortgage broker who's one of his clients at the time, answering phones. And I'm going to date myself here a little bit, but I was answering phones and manning the fax machine. You know? So some millennials may not even know what those are, but yes. So that's how I got started. Is actually we provided residential home loans, and back then this particular mortgage brokerage specialized in what they call subprime loans, so people who had less than stellar credit, provided financing solutions for them. So that was my first foray into real estate, was working with borrowers who had challenged credit and things of that nature to help them secure loans.
Got it. What was that experience like? Just starting off at that time.
So, again, dating myself. So this was in 2000. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was fun. You know, I mean, I attribute those lessons and things that I learned to why I've been able to do a lot of the things that we have done and other things that we will do. I learned, you know, coming into dealing with borrowers who had challenged credit as our initial foray into the space taught me problem solving. You know, I can recall us doing loans for people. And, you know, I can recall one time, literally, my partner and I, we spent the entire Saturday and Sunday cutting this lady's yard, getting all the weeds out and everything so that when the appraisers come, it would look like a pretty decent house. I mean, it was a nice house, but it was covered by junk debris. She had some, you know, kids who were grown but weren't really helping. And so the home needed this loan so that she could get the repairs. She didn't have a fence. I mean, it was a bad case. So we spent 2 days cutting grass and cleaning out this property so that we could help this lady get a loan. So what it taught me is about being resilient. It taught me creative solutions to solving problems. It taught me that, you know, in real estate, I commonly tell people, you know, real estate's a problem solving business. It's just the way we monetize it is through a real estate transaction. But generally, there's something non-real estate related that's caused an issue. And that's why people need investors or wholesalers or maybe it's deferred maintenance. They need a renovation person or a home builder or something like that. So it taught me that premise of this is a people business that's based around problems that you have to solve. And when you can solve those problems, then you can create value for people.
Definitely. Definitely. So I guess how did your career progress from that starting point, just kind of getting into real estate, understanding financing and things of that nature? What was the next step for you after that period of time?
So again, going back to that whole premise, those seeds had been planted. So I got into the finance space solely. Now at that time I met my wife I already kind of met her as I was transitioning into this space. She was an engineer by trade, but she had her license, her real estate license. Mm-hmm. So instantly we kind of built a business, and this was when it was a foreign concept for, you know, you to have a couple and maybe one person represent the finance side, another person represent the agency side, where I thought it was the exact opposite, because now you can have a more cohesive communication, have more seamless transaction, because you don't have these two separate entities that don't necessarily communicate so readily. Mm-hmm. So that was one of our strategic advantages is, you know, we were a one-stop shop in that regard. And so what began to happen, though, is, again, for me, it was always to get to the point of being a real estate investor. One day I wanted to build stuff and things of that nature. So I was always looking for opportunity. And given the types of borrowers we were dealing with in some cases, a lot of people would call us. You know, we were putting bandit signs out back in like 2000, 2001. So we would get, you know what, same case today, you know, which I know the topic of this isn't necessarily wholesaling real estate or what have you, but, you know, signs still work even today, as weird as that may seem, but they definitely worked back then. And one of the things about people that call on signs, in a lot of cases, they need a solution right now. Like there's a certain mentality you have to see a sign on a pole or something and you call. And so what ultimately began to happen is there would be opportunities where there was a motivated seller. Maybe they were facing foreclosure, be it a mortgage or taxes or some extenuating circumstance. And then we had people that just outright wanted to sell. Like they're like, hey, we know y'all finance, but do y'all buy as well? So we started to have opportunities that would arise that we were like, oh, okay, great. Like not only, you know, can this be a revenue generator, but this is also a marketing vehicle, because there are going to be opportunities where there will be investment properties that would come into play. And so we did. So at that time, I was getting my weight up, if you will. So yeah. I think the first two deals we did, my partner was a little bit further ahead of me financially. And so, you know, we had a scenario where we tied up a property. We had the tenant called us trying to buy the property. Unfortunately, they couldn't buy the property. And so in that process, we had to talk to the property owner. Long story short, we were able to provide that property owner a solution, help the tenant get a better house than what that house was. And we were able to wholesale that property. And so that was kind of our first deal that we did. And that was a partnership situation.
Nice. Nice. So I think there's a couple of themes I'm picking up here. So you mentioned a couple minutes ago, just how you ultimately wanted to build, and we're getting there, but it seems like each step was very intentional. Like everything you did first was complementary to what you ended up doing in the next step. So I think that's something big for people to hold on to and grasp onto, because, you know, people want to be investors, they want to be developers and do all these great things, but there are things that can be done prior to that that can set you up with the knowledge on the different aspects. So by the time you get to that ultimate goal, it's kind of like you have this tool belt of things that you know.
Man, that's a beautiful way to put it, because that's exactly what happens. You know, I share with people all the time, you know, like most people say, well, hey, you know, wholesaling is the best way to get in real estate, I've heard. And I say, well, I don't necessarily agree with that. It is easier, but I think most of us, you know, we just, if that's how you came into the industry, that's how you're going to teach it. Hey, go wholesale first. But if you didn't come into that space, you can be a little bit more objective or subjective about, is that best for everyone or most people? So, you know, I always tell people there's nothing wrong with learning the lending side, you know, becoming a lender if, you know, because a lot of people are looking for a whole career change. They don't even want to do what they do now. They want to get in real estate, but they're not ready to invest, or they don't have the capital, or maybe they don't have the skill set or the marketing capability to be successful wholesaling, or maybe they're not just going to work that hard and aggressive. There's a certain type of aggression you need to have, or analytical nature to be effective wholesaling. And I think most people, they don't pay attention to those subtle nuances. Like if you pay attention to some of the best trainers that are wholesalers, there's some similarities you'll find in their personality types. They're very, very driven. They're highly motivated, red type, A type personalities, or they're highly analytical and they focus on KPIs and marketing metrics. Then people who are maybe more like myself, I'm a more creative type. I'm what you consider, if you get into the colors of personality, I'm a blue personality. So I'm more fun oriented. To be good at wholesaling, you're looking for the bit. Technically, you're trying to get the lowest price. A lot of the properties we buy, I'm trying to give the seller the, I'm outbidding someone because I want them to get more because of the nature of properties I buy. I buy in the hood and gentrifying areas. Generally, I'm buying from an heir or someone who's owned this property for 60 or 70 years. So I morally feel obligated to pay them as much as I can, and as long as I can net what I want to net. So looking at this business and kind of learning, and I was able to learn it because I was a lender first. And so I learned the lending space. And then I ultimately got my real estate license as well, just like my wife went and got her loan license, so that we both could learn both sides of the plate. Then went into real estate investing and bought houses, fixed them up. And then ultimately I went and fixed a really in Texas, you know, I'm in Houston in the South. So we say raggedy, this raggedy house we bought, dude, that was just like the worst. And that was when I saw, you know what, it's easier to build a house than it is to fix one up. And so I had more of a linear progression into the space. And I think that more people need to understand that the real estate industry, you can make, I know some people and myself included, we've afforded a tremendous lifestyle for ourselves by providing picks and shovels within the space. So yes, you can invest, and that's ultimately the end game, but you could be like Levi Strauss did during the gold rush. He got rich off providing jeans so that people digging for gold, you know, wouldn't be tearing up their legs and getting all scratched up. So same case, you can provide the lending. A lot of people talk down on real estate agents. I say, you know, great agents make you money. They don't cost you money. So, you know, you can make a great income or provide a lifestyle for yourself as an agent, and on your way to becoming the superstar real estate investor you may aspire to be.
Definitely. And before you got into the building, you mentioned that you were buying a home and fixing them up. Were you flipping those? Were you doing some buy and holds during that period of time?
Sure. So yeah, I think my first deal that I did by myself, 15722 Barbarossa, I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
And going back to how we negotiate, but I'll never forget, just to interject this one point, mm-hmm. It was during the Christmas season and the buyers came to my office one day, and the husband, you know, he said, hey, listen, I need to get some extra money. I gave him earnest money, and he said, you know, it was Christmas time. He said, could you, you know, we need a little bit extra. And so I gave him, you know, a couple extra $100. Now I'll never forget, you know, being at my desk and he being across from me, looked up and said, man, are you going to make money? And that touched my heart because he was concerned that I would still make money with their transaction, which ultimately we did. We made a really nice little payday, but we flipped that property, just put a paint carpet. It was like a $17,000 rehab, flipped the property and made about $25,000. And then from there, it was like, wait a minute. Okay, I'm enjoying these loans, but man, 25 bands, a couple of months worth of work. I think we can do this again. So we started to flip. I always wanted to build a decent portfolio. So we would acquire some duplexes. I like duplexes because I like the premise of if one person was there paying every month, the other person didn't pay, it could cover our payment. So as long as we could cover the payment with one of the units, we will buy it. So we started to build a little portfolio. So we'd flip some and then we'd hold some.
Got it. So with your marketing, were you basically getting leads and either buying, holding them, fixing and flipping them, and maybe wholesaling a few, or is it kind of just bringing deals onto the table and figuring out what to do with them, depending on different factors?
Yeah, there was a guy, one of the old real estate teachers, he's still around, but his name is Ron LeGrand. He taught the concept of what he called the, you know, transaction engineer. And so, you know, rather than a lead coming across and I say, well, how can I do a loan for this? Or how can I flip this? I would always ask myself, what is the problem I have to solve? And how do we extract profit from this? So based on the questions you ask your brain is going to answer whatever question or seek to answer whatever question you give it. So I wanted to give myself a question that was more open-ended that would allow me to be more creative, because coming into the industry, I had to be creative. So I found that keeping that same mentality as we began to start investing more was favorable for us. So if it was a deal that the best scenario was to maybe wholesale it to someone who could pay cash, because that was going to allow them to be able to get a better margin than if they had to have additional closing costs, interest rates and things of that nature, then we'd wholesale it. If it was a deal that made sense for us to hold, then we'd do that. If it was just better to flip, we do that. If it was better to just list it on the market and, you know, let it and a lot and get rid of it that way, we do that. So we took kind of more of an open approach to opportunities at that time based on, you know, what the merits of that particular transaction or situation.
Definitely. And I like that for a couple of reasons. So you mentioned, you know, you each eventually had your mortgage license, your real estate license. And a lot of times people think of things so narrowly, right? You're like, all right, I'm a real estate agent. Like I'm a real estate agent. So I need to just focus on, you know, my clients getting their houses, but you kind of hack the system in a way, because you're like, I really like the fact that you opened it up to figure out, different ways to like what to do with when you receive deals, when you receive leads. And I like how you, mentioned just asking yourself a question about the problem you could solve. I feel like it opens up, like you said, a whole lot more possibilities. Right. And you know, if you imagine, right, if you didn't think of it that way, you could have let a lot of deals slide off the table, a lot of money slide off the table, a lot of problems you could have helped people out with just kind of like drift away just because maybe you decided not to think in an open-minded way.
Well, certainly. Well, if you're looking the way the creator designed us, right? So if you have a square, well, you have a scotoma to triangles. You're not, because they don't even register for you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You don't even see or acknowledge circles because you're looking for a square. But if you allow yourself to say, okay, it could be either of the three. It could be a triangle, it could be a square, or it could be a circle. Now, if you see any of those three, you know, your brain is smart enough to pick up on those. And so what generally happens is, like you said, you can get so narrowly focused, and there's power in focus. So it wasn't that, you know, like in our business, we kept things separated. So even when we had the license, when I had both licenses and my wife had both licenses, she didn't all of a sudden put on her loan hat. It was more or less one, she could speak from it legally with expertise because she was an agent, but she was also a loan officer. So she could talk to the client about interest rates, GFEs, and the whole nine, but still say, okay, here's the loan person. So it provided a higher level of expertise, which when you have a great deal of expertise, and it's not based on accolades and something like that, people can naturally sense it. They become more comfortable. When they become more comfortable, it's easier for you to help them solve their problems, because now they're going to be more candid and they can be more free to share with you because they have the confidence that you can help them. And so we found that having those, we were more confident because we had more tools in our belt. So I knew that if I sat down in front of you, I have a solution. Now, I don't know which solution it's going to be, but I know that. And so our marketing conveyed that. And our communication with people, it conveyed that. And then people that had worked with us were able to go out and become evangelists for us and help bring in more clients. And so, again, going through the traditional track for us was very, very favorable because we were able to take all of that knowledge and just compound it, if you will, to the next level or to the next experience. And so it was very beneficial.
Definitely. Definitely. So you mentioned early on, ultimately, your goal was to get into building. So talk to us about that transition and just taking it to the level that you always wanted to get it to.
So, you know, I believe that you should analyze and study markets. And when you do that, then you can start to assess the inefficiencies and where the opportunities were. And one of the things I noticed early on, being from the hood, you know, my neighborhood here in Houston is Fifth Ward. That's where I grew up. It's right outside of downtown Houston. And so one of the things I began to notice about communities like mine, like that neighborhood, and not just here in Houston, Houston, but all around the country. Being in transportation, I was afforded the opportunity to really travel every state in the country except for Alaska as an adult for the most part, and rode Alaska and what was one other state I can't remember. But needless to say, so I did a lot of travel, and I cross-pollinate that information and those experiences. And one of the things I recognize is that from doing loans, I saw how on the lending side, there was a space in our communities that lenders weren't necessarily serving, which meant that if lenders weren't serving it, then builders weren't even building a product for that space. And the builders that did service that space, they gave us a you knew it was affordable housing when you looked at it. No one had to tell you, because you could look at it and tell, oh, that's affordable house. That's subsidized. Like it literally advertised it based on the design aesthetics and just how it looked. And so I felt like, you know what? And at this time, this was before, you know, Rick Ross and Buy Back the Block and that whole mantra, you know, so you're talking about the early 2000s, even before the previous crash. And so, you know, I bought my first lot in my neighborhood I grew up in 2006. I paid $7,000 for it. We bought another lot in 2017 to show you what's happening in that area. In 2017, it was 400 square feet smaller than that one, and we paid $45,000 for it. So a 700% increase just on a piece of dirt. But so back when I started buying, I started recognizing that the hood, for in my mind, I just felt like the hood wasn't going to be the hood forever, because in my mind, it's already as bad as it can be. You know, it's already drugs and stuff and deprivation here. So it can't go any lower. It has to go up. And so that was just my premise. And once I started to study finance and business a little bit more, you know, I started to understand from a financial macro perspective how, because it was in a major city, close proximity to downtown, and being in transportation, I understood migration patterns and growth and things of that nature. So I started to get an understanding of how inner city areas were going to be forced to grow as cities began to grow and expand. Because here in Houston, even till today, we still have, depending on whose report, one of the longest commute times in the country. Wow. So that means you always have two forces at play in a city like this. There's always a migration of people that don't want to live in a city that going to commute in. And there's always going to be a huge number of people that want to live in the city because they don't want to commute. So all of these converging factors created an opportunity that I was able to recognize in inner city neighborhoods, because again, this was before it was popular to service these areas, number one. Number two, there weren't a lot of investors there. And number three, you could easily stand out. If you just did just a little bit, it takes just as much to be extraordinary. And so just a little bit here, just a little bit there, putting shutters on your house. So it's basic. Everything is just as big as everybody else, but we put shutters and we stain them. That one little thing stands out, you know? And so different little things that I could see that we could do represented an opportunity for me to service our market in the building and the development space.
Definitely.
Today's inspirational quote is from Julia Bien-Aimé, CEO of Lean Off Taxes. Stop postponing, trust your instinct. You'll figure out how to handle new obstacles along the way. You won't know what to expect unless you try.
And what was that experience like? You mentioned that you purchased a lot in your neighborhood you grew up in. When you bought it, like, did you know exactly what were you going to do with it? Or were you like, you know, let me just buy this lot and see what I'm going to do?
I knew it was a good deal. I knew it was a good deal. I could get it for $7,000. My wife was upset with me. But I just knew, you know, sometimes you just have a conviction. And back then I couldn't articulate it, you know, like I can now. I wasn't up on all these different macro trends and this, that, and the third. But I just knew that I knew. And again, this was my neighborhood. So at this time, I'm probably 25 or whatever, you know, I was probably 27 or 28. But this is the area I've been in since second grade. So I remember when it used to be the bloody nickel. You know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't the bloody nickel no more. It was still the nickel. It was a little blood flowing, but it wasn't the bloody nickel no more. So I had the benefit of history to kind of see where it had come from. And you know, there was just different things. Again, looking back, I remember, unfortunately, we had a friend that passed when we were teenagers. And so I went to we were at the wake, and in the place, and the wake was in one of the mortuaries in the community. And as we're sitting there, you know, I've always been a reader. So we're sitting in the lobby and I picked up this big white book because it has some cool pictures. Well, this was one of those books that's put out by like, so basically what happened was our community, it wasn't the, maybe like the civic group, but it wasn't a civic group. It was something like a civic group got with the city, commissioned a study of what could happen or how would you develop this corridor on the main streets in our community. And that's what this book was. So it showed, okay, this is, you know, how you could develop this neighborhood. And if you put properties over here and things of that nature. And so stuff like that, that happened over time, I never forgot. So coming back to when it was time to buy this lot, I was like, man, this area is going to blow. So I just had conviction and I'd seen enough. And so I took a chance. I didn't really know what I was going to do. I just knew it was a good deal. So I said, worst case scenario, I can sell it for profit or I can actually build on it at some point in time. And so that was my mission. Ultimately, I wanted to build on it, though. That was my ultimate end goal, was to build on it. I ended up selling it instead, though.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And what was, I guess, I don't know if we've ever had anybody on the show who sold a piece of land before. What was that experience like? How does that work?
Yeah. So, I mean, the cool part about land and as an investing space is there's, you know, most people that are new investors tend to shy away from owning rentals because they, you know, tenants, toilets and taxes, if you will. And so when you get in the land, you don't have any of that. All you have is taxes and then, you know, getting the grass cut from time to time. And so it's really like a hurry up and wait scenario. So the beauty in land is, you know, it's very, very low maintenance and it's really an inflation play. And just like we always say with real estate, if you buy it right, then you can, you know, if you buy, I always say you can't recover from buying something wrong. But if you buy it right, you can recover from almost anything that will happen. You can have all the worst stuff happen, delays, contractors screw up, all this stuff, and you can still recover if you bought it right. So obviously we bought it right. And what happened is I started to build in another part of town that was more expensive. So I went to a part of town that was further along in the gentrification cycle. And today it's the most gentrified part of Houston. It's a part of Houston called the Heights. So when I was buying my lot in Fifth Ward for 70, lots in the Heights were 50,000 each. So for every one I bought in the Heights, I could have been buying seven in my community. That's probably my single, one of my single dumbest business mistakes I made was going to the other folk community and buying versus staying in my community and just buying up a whole bunch of dirt. But needless to say, I was in the other area of town starting to build. And so I needed to offload that lot so that I could have that capital to further that project along. And had another investor friend that was looking and, you know, basic contract, sold it to them, kept trucking.
Got it. So talk to us about your first build.
The first build?
Yeah.
So interesting story. So I have been driving. So I bought a house at 5146 Higgins Street. Like this house had, I knew it had some roofing issues. Kind of find out it had had a fire. I knew it had some termite issues. I thought it was just in one area of the living room. Come to find out it was the entire whole front of the house had been eaten. In fact, the 2x4s, when we took the sheetrock down, you could look and you would see the 2x4 and it looked like it was regular and you grab it and it would literally had the consistency of toilet tissue, like because the termites had eaten the entire interior of the board. The only thing that was left was the exterior. So like literally it was, there were hollow 2x4s in the wall. It was the craziest thing ever. And so, you know, termites, fire damage, I had a janky contractor. Then on top of that, I had a, you know, I don't like to label people negatively. So it was a brother who had some substance abuse issues in that was around that area. And the house had aluminum siding. So I'd come one day and the whole house, you know, everything right. I come back the next day, half of my siding gone on the back. You know, I come the next day, all that siding gone on the back. Because he literally taking my siding off my house and go and sell it, you know, to get another hidden. So, man, I just had so many issues with that house that I, after that deal, I said, you know what? I could literally build a house. Building is easier than this, primarily because with building, there's no getcha, no what I call gotchas. You know, like I won't go have any termite issues like that because I already know I got to replace everything. Everything is brand new. So I put a project together and this project was in the hood. So after that, that's what made me want to go to a nicer neighborhood. Cause I don't want to deal with dudes stealing my material. I don't want to deal with this. I'm going to go over here to where, you know, I'm not in an area that's a little bit better. And so it was a Victorian style house. It was actually a fairly ambitious project. It was 14 houses that this project was slated for. And what happened? So I'm driving for dollars, driving around looking. I see this sign. I call a guy. Guy says, hey, you know, I'll meet you out there. And literally, I'll never forget, he had a black GMC Envoy. And I'm a big journal note-taking person. And so always would keep a leather journal with me. In fact, and so this conversation happened in 2005. I still have the notes from that conversation that we had. So for 2 hours, like I had never built anything. All I'd done is volunteered and helped my sister build her habitat home. But I have a thing of this little saying that when I used to do a lot of public speaking, I used to get this acronym called SDSUTN. SDSUTN. It stands for sit down, shut up, and take notes. And that is my philosophy. When I get around people that have my answer or more information than what I have, or maybe not more information, but they just have a different set of information I have, then that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sit down, I'm going to shut up and take notes versus trying to help them understand how much I know. And so a gentleman, the name was Ron. And literally I got about, this was pre-COVID. So I was maybe six, you know, a good foot from his nose. And we were just in his truck. And I just asked open-ended questions. Okay, we got a piece of dirt. What's the first thing I do? He'd explain. Okay, Nick, well, how do I do that? Who do I find? And literally this gentleman gave me a whole blueprint. He gave me a real estate development and home building course in a 2-hour time frame. Old Jewish guy and this little black kid from the ward. And literally I took like, I think it's 4.5 pages of notes in 2.5 hours. I took that information. I locked up a $750,000 piece of land that had 14 lots already subdivided. All I had to do was design the plant houses and get them and get them built, or well, design the houses, get them approved, and then get them financed and constructed. And so that was the first project. I ultimately built two of those houses. At the time, it was just me and my wife. I hadn't set up a partnership, didn't have financial partners and things of that nature, which led into some other lessons. But ultimately, I built two of those 14 houses, had to get rid of the other 12. But there was our first house built.
Wow. Wow. I like a lot about what you just shared. But first, I would say the fact that you recognize what was going on. You recognize that you were talking to somebody who had information that could change your life, and you soaked it all in. Not only did you soak it in, but use it to take action, you know? And I don't want people to miss that, because a lot of times, like, you know, we might, you know, we want to learn about a particular aspect of something, just anything in life. And sometimes people feel like I have to show this person that I know something. But in fact, if you just listen, most times it's better to just listen and speak less. If you just get the exact same impression.
You know, we already know what we know. You know what I mean? So you can't learn anything. You know, it's the reason why we have two ears and one mouth. But, you know, my premise is when I'm around people that have, again, they got the knowledge that I need. They got the, I'm going to not only take the information, but the other part that I think you're driving home is actually do something with it. I know you get it all the time. Any of us that are out here moving around, we get, you know, hey, I need a mentor. I need a coach. And what I tell people is I don't think, you know, you see right now in what I call guru world with, you know, social media and stuff like that. So everyone's a guru or a mentor. Hey, we all mentor and do certain things. And one thing I learned early on when I first came into the knowledge of what a mentor is, it truly is, and how the mentor-mentee relationship works. What most of us think is a mentor is a person who teaches us something. That's only part of it. The person isn't I'm only your mentor if I give you information and you do what I give you. You actually execute it. Most of us just got information. We don't necessarily take that information and turn it into wisdom by applying it, or we start twisting it and putting our own spin. And I'm not saying you shouldn't individualize information that you learn and make it applicable for your situation. But what I see a lot of, what we try and do a lot of times is, okay, we'll take a mentor's advice, you know, say, oh, okay, that's what I should do, but we don't necessarily do that. And so, and then we don't get that result. Well, okay, well, he told me wrong, or, you know, it was some other reason outside of me misapplying the information that I had available to me. So that was really, really key. And for me, I knew I was consciously competent in that I didn't know. Like sometimes you don't know that you don't know. So you're unconsciously incompetent. You don't even know that you don't know. I was at least smart enough to know that I don't know. And I don't even know what questions to ask and certain stuff. So that's why I would ask open-ended questions that would provide that person the opportunity to just give me whatever information that they knew that would help me. And one of the other things I found is when most people that have valuable information, they love to share it. The problem is most of us are going to interject and cut them off when they're trying to share. And then they're going to instantly recognize this person isn't receptive or ready to receive yet. So they need life or something else to happen a little bit more. Then they'll be ready. And so a lot of times we turn away a lot of the people who could really be influential in our life. Because again, going back to that point, we want them to know, oh, we've been reading, we've been studying, you know, we've been, yeah. Which that's great. That's kudos. But now isn't the time for you to, you know, get on your soapbox.
Definitely. Definitely. So what was the experience like for those first two builds? I guess, what are some lessons you learned that you carried into the future? I'm sure it was a whirlwind.
Man, listen, you know, so much of that stuff still impacts my life today and how we do things. First thing I understood is a lot of time we have what I call hero complex, and that may be culturally a part of it. And, you know, just certain backgrounds and things of that nature. But, you know, the guy that I dealt with, was worth a few million at the time we were doing this transaction. And he was only the person who did the grunt work, like the dirty work, handling the site stuff and things of that nature. It was five partners. One of the partners was a dentist. All he did was drive by every now and then, but he was a frat brother with one of the guys who was critical to getting this land replatted when they were developing and putting the land together. So that's why he was in the deal, because he could call his frat brother and maybe get something done faster or quicker. One of the guys was the money guy. He was worth $23 million. So he was the money. He was the capital guy. And then there was another guy that was a legal person. So he handled all the legal paperwork. And here I am, Lone Ranger, you know, so it's five guys at the table. All of these guys, way more successful, way more money than me. But here I am at the table by myself. And that was the first thing I learned in that. The first hard lesson, it was a very hard lesson, that success is a team sport. And, you know, yes, we may be talented or skilled and have the ability to execute certain things by ourselves. But in most cases, it may be wiser to actually have a team in place. And so that was a huge lesson. Another thing I learned, which now when I teach other people that are building and want to be developed, I tell them, you know, we as people, we love what we can't have. Like if you, you know, like you tell your friends, oh, I'm having a big party, but oh, I only have 20 people and already sold out. Well, the person who's number 21 that can't go, like they're foaming at the mouth about coming, you know, and they feel a type of way that you're not making room for them. And so one of the things I share with people is when you're doing your first deal, you have a just in case party. Just in case party is where you invite everyone who you didn't give an opportunity to be a part of this project you're doing. Because now they see this cool project. Everybody loves real estate. What are they going to want to do? Well, you just say, hey, listen, I got a couple of extra dollars. I've been reading about this. I'd love to learn know more. Only problem is you already got your deal situated, so they can't get involved in this one. But because they, if you showed this to them up front, when you first do your project, hey, this is what I'm doing. And during that party, you tell them, listen, you can't get involved right now. But the reason why I'm exposing you guys to what I'm doing, one, I want you to follow along. Two, I know many of you may be interested. And three, there may generally stuff goes wrong. None of this stuff generally happens like it should. I know they say that on the late night infomercials. I know on the TV shows, the houses always sell for top dollar and so on and so forth. But the reality of the matter is I'm expecting some things to happen. I'm looking for a couple of you to be what I call my just in case partners. So just in case something happens, you can be one of those people on that list that I call and say, hey, listen, I need $10,000. Here's the terms until I can get to here. So when you do that, now down the line, when something happens, if something happens, you have people that are already prefaced. They wanted to get involved when you initially showed it to them, but there wasn't an opportunity. 2 months later, 3 months later, you can bring them to the project. And now you're not having to get them to go from 0 to 100 to get caught up with the project because they came to your just in case party. So they've been following along, whether you've been keeping them posted or not. They know where it's at now. So they're driving by after work, showing their other friends. You don't even know this yet. And so after my experience, I said, you know what? Every time I do something, I'm going to make sure that certain key people know so that if I need them, I can call on them because I had a situation. That's why I had to sell my lot. Mm-hmm. I needed some capital. But I had people that would have invested had I provided them an opportunity to see what I was doing first. And now they could talk to their spouses about it. They could start researching and studying versus meet me today at 3:00. I need the money tomorrow by 5:00. You yeah. follow me? And so there was another tremendous lesson is to set up you a group of just in case partners. Other thing I learned is that process helped me understand something about who I am as a person. I'm real big on figuring out who you are as a person and then charting your path or course for what it is you're trying to do. A lot of us just chase the bag, literally. Okay, we can make money wholesaling. We do that. Oh, I can make money flipping houses doing that. Or I can make money doing this, doing that. Versus figuring out, well, first of all, how do you want to make money? Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Because it's not the money. It's more the process you go through to make the money. And that's where you get burnt out and things of that nature. So one of the things I found out in doing that project is I love the intricate details of building. I love of, you know, the picking out the 5-inch baseboard versus going with a 2.5-inch. And I'm going to take an extra hour to find the vendor where I can get the prices right. You know, I love picking out the nuances of how the kitchens are going to look. And I love the micro details. So I'm more, I love the developing side in terms of the creative, putting a big picture together. But my execution level, I don't want to have a suit. I had my time in life where I wore a suit and, you know, did all that. I like wearing t-shirt and Levi's and just being on site. I like the intricacies of it. So I'm not a big developer in a sense. I want to do these huge projects. So I had a project that required 14 houses be designed and built. That isn't ideally suited for who I am as a person. So that project helped me figure out, you know what? You don't want to be this big developer guy. You can do one house at a time. Do, you know, I've met developers do one house a year, but that's because they wanted to focus in. So, you know, those are just some of the key lessons I learned, you know, about myself and about the process and, you know, different things I could do to make it easier for myself as I would, you know, continue to grow in the industry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sounds like the early times in building taught you a whole lot. So where did things go from there? You know, you built the first two houses. Sure. And, you know, learn these lessons, and how did
I made it out alive. I made it out alive. You know, that project caused me to lose a lot of money because one, I didn't finish out the project. So I had the opportunity to build 14, only built two. And with projects like that, with how that project was set, more of the capital, the profit was going to be tied into properties 3, 4, and 5 and so forth. The first two were kind of taking care of a lot of the upfront cost of designing because we got I think 10 of the properties designed. So all those soft costs and all that stuff was absorbed. So after that, I kind of took a break for a second because then the market tanked. So shortly after that, we had the last financial crash in 2008, 2009. And so at that point, we had started to sell off. So prior to going into that, we had sold off our real estate portfolio, all of our rentals, because we were getting a lot of California investors coming in and they were just paying ridiculous sums of money for real estate. And so us and our finite wisdom, we just knew this is the top of the market. Like it can't get any higher. So we need to sell. And so we sold off. And so then we repositioned. And so at that point, we were like, okay, cool. You know, there's a crash here. And so at that time I had shifted out of, so when I was building, we still had our real estate team, still had the mortgage company because those things service, you know, building is a capital intensive business. I tell people, you don't come into building because it's no cash, no credit, no money. No, wrong answer. You got to stand 10 toes down when you come into the building space. You need dough and you need plenty of it. Then you need cash flow outside the dough because see, you need dough in chunks. You know what I mean? Then you need cash flow to sustain everything else that you're doing. So we still had all these different things going on. And so what we then began to do is have our real estate agency business focus more on, at that time, there were a lot of FHA foreclosures and things of that nature. So we started doing foreclosure tours. The people from Flip This House had came down and filmed us for a pilot because at that time we were doing foreclosure tours. So we bought a bus and we just take people around on the weekend showing them foreclosures. And so they came down and they filmed, it was just one show that they filmed. Well, they filmed several different cities, but the show didn't get renewed for a second year. It's called Deals on the Bus. So we transitioned our business model a little bit, focused on the Rio space and whatnot, and still would just flip a house or two here and there. And we were kind of just waiting on the market to recover. And that's when, you know, I just continued working in the hood, buying more properties. And I started to perfect more of what I began to specialize in with Houston Vintage Homes. Right around that time, I wanted to, you know, I had turned 40 and I say, you know what? I want to kind of spend the next, you know, when you're thinking 5-10 years, I want to spend the next chunk 5 to 10 years impacting this space. And it was the area I dreamt about as a kid, my neighborhood. And so I set up Houston Vintage Homes. The mission of the company was to reshape the face of inner city Houston, one home at a time. And my goal was to take everything I had learned up to that point in real estate and culminate it into this company that was going to be a design, build, and development firm. So we're vertically integrated where we could take a thought, hey, I want to go and build a duplex over here in the inner city that a lady could or whomever could house hack, live in one unit, rent the other one. We're going to subdivide this lot, sell her the duplex, then we'll build a ADU on the remaining land and keep that in our rental portfolio and different little creative products that the marketplace needed. And so I set up this company and I just began to buy, you know, houses. And I over time, I figured out a perfect formula. for how we need to work. So we buy, I buy Old Ragley houses, but I specifically buy for lot value. Mm-hmm. So I don't care what the house look like. If you will sell me a property that has a house on it or two for what people are paying for dirt, I'll buy it. And over time, I quickly started to build a reputation for that, to where whenever people have what they would think would be a teardown, I'm like, oh, let me call old crazy Tarong. I know he buy houses like this. And so I'd buy the worst house, like really the worst of the worst. And for me, I'm weird, you know, in that I figured out what I love. You send me a house in the burbs, a big, nice brick house that just needs paint, carpet, like I want to wholesale it. You know, it doesn't excite me. You send me an old bungalow with a hole in the kitchen, the foundation leaning, and it's in horrible shape. Like, you know, my eyes start glistening, my head starts shining, it's like the first time I saw my wife again. It's like I just fall in love with the house, because instantly I start painting it in the canvas of my imagination what I'm going to turn the house into. So we started to build a reputation. What still to this day makes me feel so good is when the people in the neighborhood come by the house and they start telling me stories and how the house used to look and how much better it looks today and so on and so forth. So so that's what we began to do. And as I was, you know, buy a house, fix it up and flip it, you know, I'm looking for or fix it up and rent it, we start back picking up other lots and designing projects. And, you know, whether it would be a development of four single family homes that were flipping or that we're going to rent. And one of the reasons I want to bring more people into the inner city community. In order to do that, I don't want everyone that's coming back to our communities to be renters. So we have to sell so that we can have more owners in there. But then we have to buy some or build some and rent them so that we don't displace people as well. So as the neighborhood gets nicer, they see everything getting new. Well, they want to move out of the old raggedy house into something nice. So I wanted to be able to, that's why I say I'm a developer, because you know, I could just be an investor, but my mission is highly, highly concentrated. So if I show you one house, I probably have did another one or got another one coming around a corner or around a block, or, you know, literally we can walk around the neighborhood and see different projects. And so with Houston Vintage Homes, that's just what we started to do, is build our portfolio. And going back to one other point I'd like to add right here is from what I experienced with the crashes, one of the things I've learned is there's no shortage of builders that used to build. There's no shortage of developers that used to. You got to figure out why is it used to. And I know what my experience was. And one of the things I noticed is as a builder, it's so capital intensive that when the market changes, you can't shift if all you do is build. Mm-hmm. And so I have a lot of people say, why do you buy these old houses? I understand you like them and this, that, and other, but why, from a pragmatic business reason, do you buy it? And I say, well, what you got to understand is this market we live in today, like modern day today, currently 2021, what I tell people, this ain't a real market. It's not a real market when you can put a house on the market today and get 20, 30 or offers or 20, 30 showings, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 over list price. No, no, no. That's not a real market. That's like, just be thankful that you're living during this time, but it won't always be this easy. A real market is when rates are 6%, you know, a real market when rates are 8-9% and it takes 2-3 months to sell. Well, when you go into that market, because it's not always going to be like this, and when the market changes, it changes overnight. So if you have a deep pipeline as a builder, you can't pivot. But if you have houses that you can quickly shift from being a spec house to a rent and things of that nature, then you can pivot. So we figured out a model that works for us where we have a certain amount of new construction projects, but we always keep some old raggedy houses that we're redefining and reshaping to make beautiful again, because you got to have a pretty good mix so that it allows you to be a little bit more flexible.
Today's real estate definition of the day is cap rate. Cap rate is the ratio between the net operating income and purchase price. Cap rate is calculated by dividing net operating income in the first year by the property purchase. Net operating income excludes loan cost if you used financing.
Definitely, definitely. What I like about that is, and I think a big theme throughout this interview, is that you used everything you learned to kind of almost like reinvent yourself or to refine things. You know, you realize like in the first couple of bills, like, hey, maybe, you know, maybe we shouldn't have sold off everything. Maybe we should kind of diversify a little bit. And it seems like that's what you're doing, right? Like you're selling some, you know, you have some new builds, you have some you're renting out. And so if everything goes down tomorrow, you have one thing to lean on. that could at least keep the lights on, you know?
Exactly. You know, and so what we've been able to do now, and so going back to being vertically integrated and so, in terms of our company. And so what that means is, you know, Houston Vintage Homes can actually can develop and via our sister company, which is Urban Vintage Designs, that's our design firm. And one of the reasons I created a design firm, because what most of the houses we buy, they're functionally obsolete. You know, the living room, dining room, and kitchens are all choppy. They're generally, the average house we buy is somewhere between 800 to 900 to 1,000 square feet. So that means that I'm either going to do an addition and or I'm going to move around some walls on every house we buy. And what I found myself doing is paying architects or designers to only take my thought. I sketched it out on a sheet of paper and just told them to turn it into a set of plans. And I'm like, well, yeah. Why am I paying them to take my idea? I'm not asking them to think. I've already done the thinking. And the reason why I'd done the thinking is because I used to be an agent. So I understood exactly what the buyer was looking for. I understood comps. I understood what the numbers needed to be for me to get a hard money lender to lend on this deal. So I understood all these different modalities. So I said, well, you know what? I'm going to make sure that I incorporate that into our company. And now that becomes a profit center for us. And it's something we can provide to our clients, because one of the inefficiencies I noticed in that market is, you know, like architects and your engineers are kind of sort of your prima donnas of the building space. You know what I mean? So they, like, you know, they just get to swoop in, do what they do and swoop out. And, you know, sometimes it can be difficult to get them to move quickly. You know, you try to get stuff done fast. And, you know, hey, they, you know, again, they're the prima donnas of the industry. And so to me, that represented an opportunity. So we incorporated that and then developing land, you know, just taking a piece of dirt that's maybe one lot, but it's 20,000 square feet. Well, understanding minimum lot sizes and that 20,000 square foot lot could have six lots in it now. And just by you shifting some paperwork, if you will, and a few surveys, you know, I can give you a real contemporary example via Twitter, same way you and I started dialoguing. I had a person contact us. They had paid $30,000 for, well, they contacted us, said they wanted, you know, to buy some land, got them situated with some lands, $30,000. We did roughly $10,000 worth of replatting and whatnot. And now their lot that was $30,000 has a value of about $130,000 to $140,000. Just based on one right area, it's in a gentrifying curve. And now it has a higher and better use because The way they bought it, it was just one block of land. Right now it's one block of land. Well, actually it's a block of land that's four separate lots that are ready for you to submit plans and build on. Wow. So just shifting that paperwork, you know, 400% increase in the value of the dirt. So being able to do those projects for ourselves and provide that for our clients has been key. And then obviously managing construction and building our own projects. And at any given time, we have a couple of projects that we manage for other people, but most of our building projects are forward facing to the public.
Definitely. So you have quite a lot going on. How do you enter family and everything? How do you balance everything?
Balance is an illusion, my brother. Yeah, balance is an illusion. But, you know, I mean, you know, it's an illusion in the sense, like, I don't, well, in my opinion, like, you know, you can't. So here, let me approach it like this. So our family is a real estate family, if you will. So obviously my wife is a real estate broker and runs that side of the space. My son, who's 15 now, is his title in Houston Vintage Homes is a VP of operations. He flipped his first house when he was 12. You know, in his college fund. Yes. And so, you know, real estate's a part of what we do. So, you know, one, we're all involved in what we do. Number one. Number two, like we kind of built our lives and our business around what we wanted. Like we literally sat down and said, I had this exercise called design your ideal day. Write down exactly what you want your life to look like. What time do you wake up? What do? Who do you do it with? You know, do you wake up, go to gym or pray or do whatever it is you do? Just write it down and define literally what the ideal day looks like for you. So now you have a target where there's clarity of vision, there's acceleration towards the known purpose goal. Most of us don't have a clear picture. We just think we want money. But what you'll find out as soon as you get the money, you're not happy because it's the journey to getting the money and not the money itself. Success isn't a destination. It's a journey. So you got to define what you want your journey to look like. The life I live right now, I wrote down in a journal I could show you from 1994. You know what I mean? When I was driving truck cross country, I used to visualize, how do I want my life? You know, when we retired the first time, I used to, you know, one of my missions when I was 35 is, hey, I want to do nothing. I want to get to a point in life where our cost of living and everything is so is such that I could wake up in the morning and do nothing. I don't have nowhere to be, nothing to do. So we did that. Then once you do that for a little bit, you get bored because most people at work or whatever the case may be. So now you got to find other pursuits. So going back to the whole point of balance and things of that nature, I am here because I made an appointment or a destiny with my life to be here based on decisions I started making 3, 4, 5 years ago. So whether I'm balanced or not, I don't really know. That's why I say it's an illusion. What I do know is I have what I wanted. I created this. And so right now I'm creating what's going to happen the next 5 to 10 years and so on and so forth. So to me, I'm more mission driven. You know what I mean? I figure out what my mission's going to be and I fall in love with the journey. I understand there's going to be ebbs and flows. There's all this other stuff you can't control, you know, but if you're taking a flight and you're driving, so you're in LA, when you drive from where you live to the Inland Empire, you're not focusing on, you know, every little thing that you see on that trip that isn't in line with you getting to the IE. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You just finna hop on and boom, burn off. Now, there may have been some stuff. You may have some, you know, traffic, this, that, and the third, but you didn't magnify the traffic. You magnify where you were going. Mm. And so that's my same philosophy, you know, is, you know, I'm here because this is what we created. And so if there are any adjustments, now I just got to write in what those adjustments are and make the corresponding actions in my everyday efforts to line up with what I want.
Definitely, definitely. And how does it feel just to be providing this service in communities with people who look like us and, you know, you're part of it and you're helping people who look like you and bringing people back to the communities? How does that feel? Have you ever thought about that?
Man, I think about it all the time. You know, if I'm honest with you, there have been times I've sat in my truck or in the house and cried because of the impact that it's had. You know, there's a Miss Hobbs, a lady across the street from one of my houses in my hood I'm doing right now. Like literally, you know, I'm getting out of my truck and every time she sees me, she say, oh, the house looks so good. Baby, I'm praying for you. Like it touches me. It really do because this lady's lived in her house going on 40 years and she's watched this neighborhood go through all these different iterations. Then she watched what we're doing. I mean, and literally the projects I do, like this house literally was in the dirt. Like, so when we say we get it out of the mud, like literally the foundation of this house, the 4x4s, because it was a house on stilts. All the houses we buy are on stilts. They're on a pier and beam foundation or what we call them here. So this house was supposed to be 2 feet off the ground. Well, over the last 10, 15 years, that 2 feet had dissipated to where the foundation of the house was literally in the dirt. So we had to jack the house up, build an entirely new foundation around it. Well, so we got a $130,000 budget for this house. You know, we only paid 60 for it because in this area, lots were going for 80. So we paid 60 because it was a great deal. Anyway, to see that transformation, now I could show that house to you and you'll say, oh man, it looks nice, but it doesn't have the impact as it does when another one, the little homies, when they see me in the neighborhood, like when I walk into the store, they call me buy back the block. You know what I'm saying? And that means something to me because now they are associating all this hard work and efforts now with what they see me do. I was just in the neighborhood yesterday and another buddy of mine. So there's these same houses I'm doing are in a kind of hot part of the neighborhood. You know, everybody kind of hang in this area. And he had been hearing other people talk about the house. And so just he said, man, hey, AT, I went and drove by that house the other day, man. Hey, you're doing your thing over there, you know. And it, again, and so it's those kind of interactions with people that normally wouldn't pay attention to real estate. Mm-hmm. Now he's having conversations with me about what he and his wife can do in terms of investing in the community. Now I have young brothers who maybe were looking at other solutions to solve their, you know, financial issues and things of that nature who are now trying to learn the business of real estate. And, you know, one of them's looking to get into wholesale. Another young brother's now pursuing becoming HVAC tech, because another thing I'm big on is, which is the next iteration of what we're doing with Houston Vintage Homes. And I set up another company called Urban Builder School, because it's one thing to go in there and, you know, fix up stuff, but you got to engage the people mm-hmm. that are in there, not just on the consumer side where they can buy from you or rent from you, but why not empower them to earn income from what's being built there? Because, you know, me and other investors laugh about this all the time. You know, my electrician probably does, you know, $600,000 a year. My foundation guy, I'm sure he's doing $500,000 or better. The plumber, I know he's doing that. And wow. These are individuals, of course. I mean, so you just think think about it. What if some of these individuals that are in these communities were able to get some of those, you know, maybe they're not going to be as prolific as these guys, but a six-figure income from, you know, doing plumbing or being a framer or being an electrician, you know, or get at least becoming an apprentice or becoming an HVAC tech. So it's been powerful to me because now I'm having conversations with people who didn't even see this as an industry. I have two different friends that are now HVAC techs well on their way to having their full-fledged license because I'm in the hood. So you can't miss the household that Atarin did because you remember the house that was burnt down. Okay, now it's some dope urban mod, you know, modern home that's, you know, worth $290,000 now. And we bought it for 70, put 120 in it and made it look amazing. You can't miss it. So now that poses them to ask other questions and things of that nature. So being able to put nice housing in the community, but also being able to engage people and plant seeds for other kids, just like someone planted the seed for us when I volunteered for Habitat for Humanity. So, you know, several different aspects of this that truly makes me feel good. And just to really know that, you know, I'm impacting the area positively and impacting the people in the area simultaneously, you know, so it's truly humbling. And, you know, sometimes be like, man, you know, cause you know, it's, you know, we've done some great things, but I mean, what's to come is even greater. So sometimes you can, so I don't like to read the press, if you will. And so because you'll start getting in the stargazing mode. So I just like to, you know, keep my head down, go find a raggedy house to fall in love with and just stay enamored in the process. And I set the dreams up and kind of just let them, you know, kind of matriculate and manifest as they see fit.
Definitely. And what would you say to someone who is interested in doing what you do, interested in, you know, designing or rebuilding? What are some things they should keep in mind? You know, because, you know, once they hear this interview, they'll be able to see the path that you took, but what are a couple of things you would say you should strongly consider or do these couple of things?
So, you know, the kind of person I am, so I'm an information person. And so, you know, so I like to find out what I don't know. And nowadays, you know, you have YouTube and things of that nature. When I first got in the industry, you know, it wasn't a YouTube. So places like YouTube are great, but me, there's nothing like reading a book. You know, it's just nothing like holding something tangible and getting, because see, you know, it's real estate, not virtual estate, although there is some virtual real estate, but it's a real tangible business. So I believe that, I think you got to get engaged in the learning. So get real deep on the learning side. So obviously, you know, YouTube's fine. But what I did personally, I went to the bookstore and got every book on real estate I could find. And I read it. And this was back in the day when they had Barnes and Noble and Walden Books where they had the couches and stuff. So I just go in there and post up and just read everything. So one, I believe that a lot of times people, especially when you want to get into building, see, there's a lot of challenges. I call it organized chaos. And so the power, your willpower is strengthened by information. A lot of us try and undertake stuff without adequate information. Doesn't mean you didn't go to a mentor and they gave you just the right 2, 3, or 4 points to get from point A to point Z. The problem is you don't have all the gray minutia information so that you can be confident that when you do those 4 steps, it's going to work. So you got the right information, but you don't have the confidence to execute it because you don't have a strong enough willpower. So I like to go and get a lot of information. So I read, so I tell, hey, if you want to get interested in home building, go on Amazon and get several books. Most people say, well, you know, which one do you recommend? All of them.
Yeah.
Like literally all of them. Like I would buy books that I bought books on how this guy, when I was studying building, you know, there's a book on how to build an affordable house. I bought that book by a guy named Fernando Ruiz. There's another guy who who set a record for building a house in a certain period of time. And so his was all about efficiency and planning and so on and so forth. So I just buy that book. So anything that related to the topic, I just buy the book because when I look at it for $25-$30, I may learn one thing in there that saves me 10 grand on a property. It's always a win-win. So I can't lose by having more information. So number one, get very excited and motivated about acquiring information is the first thing. Number two, seek out tangible people in your marketplace that are doing what you're doing and make yourself available to them. You know, in Houston, Houston is a city that's over 700 square miles. There's a certain part of Houston where I've driven literally every street in this area multiple times. Like, so there, if you circle inner city Houston, 16 loop, I've literally driven every street multiple times. I can tell you what was there last last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So I'm an expert in that market because I literally got, you know, just burnt some gas driving through, getting intimate with the market. So the second thing is get intimate with a marketplace. You know, if you're going to whatever part of town, and you may not know which part of town. So that means you got to burn more gas so that you can start to figure out some sensibilities and start to be able to analyze that market and then start to look into the, your local MLS. So you've already gotten a high level information about what's out there. Then you're starting to drive the areas. Now you're finna get into more of the professional side of things because you're going to marry this research, this grassroots research you did with more of some more organized information from the MLS. And they say, well, what am I looking for? So, well, it's not so much what you're looking for specifically because you're still learning. So everything you see is a part of your learning process. And a lot of stuff you're going to learn right now is going to be unconsciously competent. Mm-hmm. You know it, but you don't know that you know it yet. But you're not going to know that you know it until a demand has been placed on that knowledge. So once you learn that information and then you move to the next step, which is making connections, meeting with trades and things of that nature. I would talk if I saw some guys, and I still do this to this day. If I drive by a house and it looks amazing and I see them start working, I'm finna pull over and go and walk on site. And most people are like, well, why would you do that? Hey, you know, like, I'm a fan of what I do. So if I see guys working, I'm not trespassing because I'm finna go talk to him and ask him, okay, you're a framer. How much you charge? Can you tell me about this project? Most people who build houses like are craftsmen or artisans and they love what they do. So they're excited when they meet somebody who is excited about what they do. So you'll be surprised how many guys will talk to you, give you information. And again, if you're not trying to flood their ears with how much you know, and you just ask open-ended questions and to show them that you're teachable, coachable, and trainable, they'll share with you resources. Hey, call my boss, go over here, look at this. So get into the marketplace and start shaking hands, kissing babies, and meeting people that are in the space, contractors, home builders, architects, designers, city planners, permit runners, all the people that are within that ecosystem. Start making connections with those folk because those folk are going to be valuable, key, critical pieces as you start to put deals together. If you do just those few things, you'll have a head start on, you know, 60 to 70% of people in the marketplace, because most people aren't going to go on Amazon and get 5 or 6 books. Yeah. Like, they're going to stop right there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Most people aren't going to go to that next step. So those are just a couple things that you can do. One big point that I will tell you that I definitely want to get out in terms of what's happening in our communities. A lot of people believe that now that, you know, because now you have more people talking about investing in our communities, buy back the block and things of that nature. A lot of people are taking the notion that, oh, I'm too late, because what they're like, for instance, when I tell my friends I bought a lot for 7 and that, now, you know, in 2007, I paid 45. They're like, man, why you ain't call me when you was paying 7? I said, because you wasn't ready to buy a 7,000. I was a trailblazer. Well, now, and they said, well, why you ain't call me at 45? Because see, now the same area where we bought a lot for 45 in 2017, we got one under contract right now that's 110. Wow. So from 2000, exactly. So it's dang near tripled in 3 years. So, and now they're saying, well, man, I don't want to pay 110. Why you ain't call me back when it was 45? And so I share with them a lesson that Mr. Hodges taught me. Mr. Hodges is a guy from my neighborhood. He's about 80 years old. And when he got started in real estate about 50 years ago, it's him and several buddies. And they all stopped and he's the only one still going. And so one day we were talking, I said, Mr. Hodges, why are you still successful doing deals and they're not? He said, Tyrone, they wouldn't pay the new price. You got to always buy at the new price. That changed my life when he told me that, because what we want to do is go back in time. And so just like I told my buddy, I said, this lot that's 110,000. Mm-hmm. Do you think that lot is going to go back down to 80,000? Like, inflation isn't taking place. We're not having deflation in real estate. We have inflation. It's going to increase, you know, even when you're waiting on this crash that you're hoping gonna hit sometime, you'll still look, it may dip down short term, but it's gonna go back up in price. But so that's the first thing people need to understand, is it's not too late. Most of our communities are located in areas that are prime areas. And as you look at the forces that affect most major metropolitan cities, these areas are going to go up, if for no other reason than inflation, in addition to all the other converging factors like the opportunity zones. That's a huge thing that's impacting what's going on in our areas, because that's now bringing capital that would have never been deployed into these areas to our communities. Another important statistic that most of us need to understand so that we can wrap our minds around the enormity of the opportunity that's in many of our communities is this. Depending on whose math you want to subscribe to, there's anywhere from a 9 to 11 million home shortfall of affordable housing. Like literally, our country needs somewhere between 9 to 11 million brand new affordable housing stock. So that's why you see a lot about, if you kind of pay attention to the buzzwords, 3D printing, modular homes, container homes, all these different solutions to try and figure out how to get more houses built in our country. And so it's not too late for you to get involved in real estate. It's definitely not too late for you to start buying in some of our communities. And when you understand how big the need is for affordable housing, you now can stop trying to catch crashes and understand that, you know, it'll be years before we build enough affordable housing. And primarily because if a builder can sell a house for $500,000 versus building one and selling it for $300,000, most of them are going to opt to build a $500,000 house for more profit. Somebody has to make a concerted decision to say, I'm going to service this middle housing market here. And I may not make as much money, but I'll feel a lot better about what I'm doing. I can do some socially conscious impact investing, and I can see a true tangible return on what I'm doing outside of money. I can see firsthand how me investing in an area and providing housing can impact the community, because the only thing that rivals real estate is oil. Oil touches literally every industry. The second most impactful industry when you're trying to impact a socioeconomic environment is to build or provide housing, because it literally provides so much employment and opportunities for so many people. So I know there's a whole bunch there, but I just wanted to get out some of those because I think people think it's too late.
No, I agree with that. I appreciate you diving into all that. It's definitely stuff we all need to know, and we all need to be thinking about. Man, this has been jam-packed interview, full of game. I think it's just the thing that sticks out for me is just the progression that you made throughout your career, and just everything you learned, and how you just use it to continue to move forward and ultimately impact our people and help out the community. And so, you know, I definitely believe our audience will get a whole lot out of this. But before we wrap, could you just let us know where people can learn more about your company, learn more about your companies, rather, what you're doing, any services or offerings you may have that people can take advantage of, and of course, your social media handles too?
Most certainly. So you can find us on IG at Houston Vintage, VINTAGE Homes. That's where we update and keep most of what's going on projects-wise and things of that nature. You can also find our design firm, which is Urban Vintage Designs. That's also on Instagram. I hold what we call a masterclass. In fact, our next will be next month. And it's called the Renovation and New Construction Masterclass. And it's where we take both business models in 2 days. One day is dedicated to the buy, fix, and flip or renovation business model. One is dedicated to new construction. We actually go out into our own projects and show you different projects that we have underway. And so you can get more information about the next classes coming up at buytheblockmasterclass.com. And yeah, you can also find me on Twitter at Tyron McDaniel and or the Urban CEO is my handle. So again, I appreciate you for having me on, and it's been a pleasure to kind of share, and it's reminded me of some other stuff I need to go do now, but it's been fun, man.
Definitely. Yeah, it's been fun. I'm looking forward to playing this back. It's just full of gems. So, you know, people better listen to the whole thing because you don't want to miss it. Definitely, man. I appreciate it. Well, thank you all again for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. If you want to keep up with us and what we're doing, text BRED to 21,000. If you'd like to support us as an official patron, go to patreon.com/blackrealestatedialogue. I look forward to hearing from you all soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue and on Twitter at Bread Podcast. That's BRED Podcast. Until next time.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. We ask that you kindly not be that guy, and instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone from their top brands in any condition on any unlimited plan for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 with Galaxy AI.
With new line on my plan, additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And future stronger you can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See Home Club for details.